Every episode of the podcast is brought to you by Bill Fick Ford and the WCRA. Thank you to Train Shot. Guys, Bill Fick Ford is the number one Super Duty dealer in the country for the fourth year in a row. You guys have heard me rant and rave about Bill Fick Ford for the absolute best buying experience in the car industry, truck industry. Bill Fick Ford's the place to go. I bet you remember the old ad where I said I was getting a new Super Duty. Well, here's the keys for that. Bill Fick Ford delivers, guys. Noble discounts, noble interest rates, the best buying experience you can get. And if you are not local to Huntsville or the Houston area, he'll deliver it to you just like he did to me. Bill Fick Ford. If I say, who wants to be a millionaire? Would anybody not put their hand up? Of course not, especially in rodeo. Well, thanks to the WCRA, the dream of a $1 million purse has finally come true. You can win $1 million by nominating your rides and runs and earning points with the WCRA. Through the Triple Crown of Rodeo, the WCRA will award a $1 million cash prize to any athlete or collection of athletes who wins first place in any three consecutive WCRA major rodeos. $1 million up for grabs, which is pretty much unheard of. Rodeo Corpus Christi will be the very first stop in the 2021 Triple Crown of Rodeo. The event will pay over $540,000. Yes, I said it, $545,000, and will be held on May 6th through May 9th. There will be zero entry fees. That's right. You don't even have to pay to enter this rodeo. The only thing you have to do to qualify for the Triple Crown of Rodeo event is by nominating your rides or runs with the WCRA. Here's the common misconception with the WCRA. It's just for the pros, for the elites. Well, if you can hang with these people, but maybe you don't want to commit to pro rodeo. I get it. It's a big commitment. The WCRA is made for people like you because you can enter these events, nominate your rodeos, and win crazy money, just like Rodeo Corpus Christi and this $1 million we keep talking about. To learn more, just visit triplecrownofrodeo.com. Again, that's triplecrownofrodeo.com to see how you can earn a spot at Rodeo Corpus Christi and possibly be the rodeo's next millionaire. Pow! Guys, if you're like me, you're hoarding your guns and ammo right now. We don't know what the heck is going on. Here's the thing. You can't get ammo, so the last thing you want to do is train and use up your ammunition. But of course, on the flip side, you've got to train if you want to be effective with your arms. That's where our partner Train Shot comes in. They've created a seamless app and device that allows you to shoot and improve your skills. No tapes required, no spotting scopes required, no wasted time downrange. You will also save a ton of money using Train Shot because you don't use the same amount of ammunition and supplies that you would with traditional targets. The app is designed specifically to save you time and, of course, the ammunition we keep referencing. You can track your speed, your improvements over time, draw time, reaction time, shot-specific recovery time, how badly you can beat your buddies, because that's one of the best parts. You can compete across the United States with anybody who has a Train Shot or specifically with your friends. Guys, this is one of the funnest ways to drill and shoot. The ammunition savings alone covers the cost of the unit itself. And of course, all you have to do is download the simple app. Train Shot is one of my favorite products for 2021. Get yours today. Go to trainshot.com. Again, that's trainshot.com. And here's what's great. If you get this from the gauge, use their promo code for a special treat. Use promo code free ammo to get one box. That's 50 rounds of 9mm MagTech, 115 grain FMJs. And these aren't cheap reloaded junk, guys. This is good stuff. Again, that promo code is free ammo at trainshot.com when you purchase your Train Shot.
This is The Gauge with host Chance Conradude.
Are you freaking serious? It's Conrado. This is The Gauge, and I am Chance Conrado. On this episode of the podcast, we have got Dr. Marty Tanner, one of the most esteemed veterinarians in all of rodeo. He's got a great history. He works on some of the best barrel horses and rope horses in the industry. I think if you ask somebody like Brittany Posey, Marty Yates, Ivy Conrado, so on, they will tell you that he is a absolute lifeline, and he's a very funny, entertaining guy. I love Marty to death, so tune in. I don't think we've ever had a vet on the show, so if I was going to pick one, it'd be this guy. Check it out. About the most.
Okay.
So I know that it's just, we were kind of track kids a little bit with Kelly, and we spent so much time in the summers on the track in Colorado, and it's just such a different world.
It is a different world. Teaches you a lot about a horse, though.
Well, yeah. I mean, the demands that are on the all quarter horses are Everything.
No, thoroughbreds too.
Really?
Probably just as many on the
no
thoroughbred
kidding.
Side as the quarter horse side.
Yeah. See, I just.
Just like, for me personally, the practice that I was with was heavier on the quarter horse racing side.
Yeah. But yeah, naturally, right, I guess.
I had kind of already fallen in love with thoroughbred racing, so I kind of graduated that way a little bit.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what did you like about it? Just how much longer the race was in comparison to a quarter mile? Or
I don't know, just the mystique of it. You know, it's you know.
The history is richer, right, on the track.
Yeah, on the old Sport of Kings thing.
Yep.
You know?
It really is.
Legacies of those horses, hundreds of years, you know, that they've kept up with it and tried to breed it on, so.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Like, if you look back at the history, I mean, that was like a crutch, an American crutch.
Yeah.
You know, racing, everybody's watched that Seabiscuit movie, but, I mean, that is literally one thing, that in baseball, that carried, like, our nation.
It was.
Through a difficult time.
If you look back historically, you know, that was the number one sport in America.
Yeah.
During its heyday, you know.
Yeah, people know about one now.
Yeah.
Maybe three if they look at it longer than just a minute.
Yeah. Everybody watches the first Saturday in May, but
they do.
Of course, this year it wasn't in May. But
yeah. Or what was when it was?
Yeah. Or the people betting too.
Yeah.
You know what, Ty? I thought you were going to ask what we were talking about for a second.
I'm a little more informed, at least.
Yeah. Well, he's improved, but
yeah.
So I mean, what was it that I think you're the first vet we've had on too?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Veterinarian. We've had military vets on.
Yeah. I was going to say.
Yeah. Again, yeah. You're confusing Ty. But, I mean, what was it that made you want to even get into that field in the first place? I mean, it is a tough
job. The rodeo
job.
Field?
Well, not the rodeo field. Veterinary
medicine?
Set the stage. Yeah, veterinary
you
medicine.
You know, I don't know. I can't remember. I don't ever remember wanting to be anything else. I grew up in the cattle industry. My grandfather, which is one of my heroes, started an auction barn in 1942.
Where was that?
In Mississippi.
Mississippi, of all
places. Southern Mississippi.
Woo.
Yes. And so my father worked it, and I worked it, you know. And so when we got older and they were like, okay, who's going to take over the auction barn business? And I'm like, I'm out. No, that's a lot. That's a hard way to make a living. It's a great way to make a living.
That's even harder now probably than it was then.
Probably so, yeah. The margins are a lot less. And so I just wanted to be a veterinarian. You know, I'd always been around animals, but I just gravitated towards the horses. You know, I think it's just a God-given deal. Kind of nudged me a little bit that way.
You know,
I just enjoyed it. And never really, I'm blessed because I love what I do, and I've always been able to do it and never had to do anything else. You know, so it's almost like you're not going to work. You get to go play each day, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've been, you know, in the field of veterinary, or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, however you say, whatever the abbreviation for veterinary in the field of, you tell me. You're the expert. But, I mean, you've been blessed to work on some pretty incredible horses.
Yeah, I have
especially
been.
Lately.
Yeah, I have been. Probably, I tried to count it up. I think this year was about my 15th NFR. That I've actually gone and worked on horses. The first NFR client I had was Brittany Posey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so at that time she had Leroy. So that's when she was Rookie of the Year. So that's, I don't want to date Brittany. She may get me in trouble for that. Giving her age away.
Well, yeah, if you know Brittany at all, you know that she's probably get mad very easily.
And so Leroy was the first horse I worked on for her. And so it's her. Stitch, Duke, and then, you know, just once I got into the field, you know, I loved it, and so I just built on it from there, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, that was before you had started your own clinic and you were in Elgin and all that stuff, right? Yeah.
Well, so when I actually worked at Elgin when I was in vet school. That's mm-hmm. how long I've been associated with that practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, a long time.
Yeah.
And so good guys there, learned a lot. It was a great place to nurture a young veterinarian because you were around some of the founders of the equine sports medicine.
Right.
You know, cutting edge. And you had guys that, you know, Dr. Graham, Dr. Lewis, Dr. Hayes, those guys, they put you in an environment that you could really learn. It was unique because there was a lot of numbers, but also, you know, there were horses coming from all over the country, and So Dr. Lewis would pull me aside. He'd give me, you know, and commercial haulers were bringing them in. It weren't like you were face to face with the client, right?
Right.
So he would give me a case. He'd say, go work this horse up. Here's what's happened. You go tell me what's wrong with this horse. Well, then I'd go work the case up, and I'd come back and tell him, this is what I think. He'd say, okay, let's go look together. And then he would teach me from that, either confirm, yeah, you're right, or no, here's where you missed it. And I never had to fail in front of a client. It was a buffer there, you know. I just talked to him, and then he in turn talked to the client. So that made it a really unique.
Probably an easy way to build your confidence over time, right?
It was. Because you got numbers, you know, and that's, you know, you learn by numbers.
Yeah, yeah, in medicine, of course. Yeah.
But you didn't have the stress of having to look bad in front of somebody, you know. So it was a good nurturing experience. A lot of hours.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Yeah, as youngsters, we called it Alcatraz.
I'm sure they'd love to hear that now. Like, as you've left and got your own flourishing thing in Brock, you got your whole deal going. Yeah. But, I mean, I find it very interesting, right, that circling kind of back to the beginning of what we were talking about, like, you know, you alluded to wanting to get into medicine and you never thought you wanted to be anything else. But I mean, how did you go from point, hey, I want to do this? Like, where'd you go to school? Cause these are things I don't know. I know some people.
Yeah.
Do,
so
but I don't.
Obviously I grew up in a little town called Lewisdale, Mississippi. And so I, once I graduated high school there, I went to Mississippi State. And, you know, I've always been kind of a really self-driven person. So when I graduated high school, I was 17. I went to Mississippi State. There were more people on campus than there were in my hometown. Literally. Actually.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not joking.
Yeah.
Sounds like a lot of towns in Mississippi, probably.
Yeah. And so I'd finished my prereqs. You know, I just was on a crash course. I did them in 2 years. So I started vet school when I was 19.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you graduated high school at 17 and just knocked it out.
Yeah. And vet school at 19, graduated there when I was 23. So.
I mean, you were on a rocket ship to try to get it done. You wanted to be like one of the youngest vets in the country is what you were going for.
I didn't take time to smell the roses very much, yeah.
Yeah.
At the time, I was.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you didn't really get to have an authentic college experience.
No.
You were too buried in the books.
Didn't have that at all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is it hard to get into that vet school? Because, like, I'm from a state I won't name because people on the podcast get mad when I say, I'm from Colorado. In fact, they made a whole drinking game about it on Twitter.
I'm taking a drink right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, it doesn't count. It's a blueberry Red Bull. That's not alcohol. But, you know, everybody would try it. Like, tons of people would try to get into the CSU vet program, right?
Yeah.
And it's very tough to get into. Was it a similar thing at Mississippi State?
It was. There were about 600 applicants for 32 spots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how did they pick those? Best grades,
they look at your grades, and then they did an interview, personal interview, and then you had recommendations, you know, so it was kind of a three-part process.
Yeah.
So.
All worked out.
Yeah, it all worked out.
Well, and then so you graduate, and then, I mean, in veterinary, just people who may not understand, I mean, do you go into an internship directly after that, kind of like regular medical
field?
You
can if you want to go into a specialty
field,
you know, where they have like an internal medicine specialty and that kind of stuff. So there are avenues of that. I kind of did my practice like I did my education, you know.
Yeah.
I hit the ground running.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and so you went right into residency.
I mean, post-grad, like I didn't do any postgraduate training. I just went to work.
Yeah.
You know, but I got in the right spot and just built it from there, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and from that point, when was it that you ended up at the track?
A little bit in Mississippi, but not much. Mostly when I got to Elgin, you know, mm-hmm. At the time, Maynard Downs, which was a quarter horse track, was mm-hmm. just literally 15 minutes down the road.
Sure.
You know, so I'd go work the backside of Maynard Downs. And then as I picked up clients there and Dr. Lewis helped me, he knew I was really infatuated with thoroughbred racing. So if he had new thoroughbred client, you know, trainers,
mm-hmm.
needed a veterinarian, you know, he would kind of introduce me to them. Dallas Keene, who's a really prominent thoroughbred trainer, was my first client in Texas.
Wow. Talk about pressure.
As a thoroughbred trainer, yeah. Don't worry, just go do this.
Yeah, exactly.
you build on your work, you know,
right.
basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, anybody who has horses or has competed in anything on their equine athletes know that, I mean, vets are, the right vet is hard to find as the right horse almost. I mean, we could look at what happened to J-Lo, for instance, this summer.
Yeah.
And I mean, look at what happened there. I mean,
yeah,
you were on the ground helping Ivy get through that stuff. But I mean, we're talking about a vet not knowing what the hell they're doing. How do you fill a lung on a horse like that? That just doesn't make sense.
Well, you know, I think they always, there's a couple of rules they teach in vet school. They say, you know, above all else, do no harm.
Yep.
You know, the other one is all bleeding eventually stops.
Right. Yeah, eventually. Yeah.
Yeah. That one's not too comforting when you give it to your clients, but.
No, especially if they barrel race.
So, yeah, it's a blessing for me to do this work, but you got to remember the responsibility you have. You're working on horses that people make their living off of.
Yeah, well, I mean, and even at its most basic level, like even if you're working on cattle and things like that, I mean, everybody in this Western space, these animals are prized above oneself, right?
Yeah.
It's always been that way for us. I mean, since I was able to walk, it's horses first, right? Because without the horses, well, you know, you don't get what you need, your food, your clothing, the heat in the house. You know, these equine athletes are the ones who make that happen.
You know, and that's hard. I think growing up in the cattle industry helped.
Yeah.
Put an emphasis on that because you took care of the cattle before you took care of yourself.
Right.
You know, because that was your livelihood. And so that's just second nature. I never looked at it any other way. So that probably helped in hindsight, you know, keep your emphasis on how important your job is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Circling back again, though, I mean, when is it that you kind of finished out your time at the track? Or I mean, you may still rarely do that, but it seems like anything other than like the major thoroughbred racing is like, I don't know if there's like this power it'd be that's trying to get rid of racing.
Yeah,
but it's diminishing a lot, like the greyhound industry was.
Yeah, the greyhound industry's essentially gone away now.
Yep.
So as I got more involved in the rodeo world, you know, it's work and you spend you only got so much time,
right?
You know, so I still have some of my thoroughbred clients, you know, they'll come see me.
Sure.
And Brock or, occasionally I'll travel to the racetrack, not near as much as I used to.
Right.
And I think when you're younger, you know, and you're trying to establish those relationships, you know, you probably travel more to those, setups just so you can kind of take care of your clients, you know?
Right?
And then as you get busier, you know, then you kind of narrow that group. The group gets narrowed down just by time. I mean, you only got so much time, you know.
Right. Well, and I mean, when you reach a certain level in your industry, right? When you've built up the, you know, the rapport with people over years and years and years. I mean, that's kind of a veterinarian's dream, right? Is to have a clinic that you have so much rapport that, you know, high level people want to come to you exclusively.
Yeah, it is. I mean, yes, it is. I mean, I'm not going to tell you any different. I mean,
right.
It means a lot to me,
right,
to be in that situation. But I think you have to be your hardest critic. I'm harder on me than anybody else
sure.
could ever be, you know, and I don't ever take that for granted. You know, when I went to Elgin, Dr. Graham was the senior guy there, and he and I kind of hit it off. And he, you know, he probably taught me as much about just how to practice, not necessarily the medicine part of it, but just how to handle people or, you know, what to not take for granted. He always told me things like, he said, you're only as good as the last horse you worked on.
Right.
And if you mess that one up, you're a mess up.
Right.
He didn't quite use those descriptive words.
More or less.
More or less.
Was he an eloquent speaker or a sailor?
A sailor.
Yep.
you know, and he would always say, and this is, I see this missing some in our profession,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, he said, just remember, when they pull into your parking lot, more than likely they drove by another veterinarian to get to you.
Right.
So you better treat them that way.
Yeah, I mean, we've all pulled into a vet where they treated us like garbage. Let's be real, at least on the guy paying the bill or supposed to be paying the bill side. The untold truth about a veterinarian is how hard it is to get your invoices paid sometimes, probably.
But, you know, so I try to remember those things.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. And it's true. And no more, and something more than rodeo, you know, in specific. And I mean, gosh, I mean, how many calls do you get on a daily, weekly, monthly basis from people, you know? Yeah. I mean, you probably couldn't even tell.
I can't count.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably couldn't even tell how many times Brittany or Ivy or Marty Yates or whoever has called you, you know, I mean,
I don't really worry about that. I worry if they don't.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, are they cheating on me with another bet or something happened? I mean, yeah, I could only imagine all that, but it's interesting, right? Cause you got, so Brittany was your first rodeo client, you know, and then you kind of
at that level.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you knew enough about barrel racing as a sport and, you know, obviously the sport of rodeo, cause you didn't necessarily rodeo yourself or really come from a rodeo background.
Not at all.
So at that point, I mean, when did you recognize, was there a part of you was like, huh, I didn't realize rodeo was this big of a thing or,
No, I don't know that I looked at it that way. I think more I looked at it as like I could take, you know, it's just racing.
Yeah.
It's just a different kind of racing.
Right.
You know, and at that time, I don't feel like the rodeo world, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, you know, but those horses weren't necessarily looked at that way.
Yeah, lots changed.
I don't know if I'm putting that in the
right
words.
No, that makes total sense.
You know, and so it's, so I was able to apply just that philosophy to that discipline,
right,
because it really is the same as far as that horse is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, he's just doing his job, whether he's running in a straight line in a quarter of a mile, you know, making four turns on the, you know, on the mile track or or whatever. I do wonder, though, like just from a pure veterinarian standpoint, if you're comparing the disciplines, you know, and you're breaking down joints and things like that on the horses. I mean, it just seems like maybe because of the way barrel racing in specific is set up or even tie down, that those horses are probably a little harder to keep sound.
It's harder to work on a rodeo horse than it is a racehorse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not quite as pampered. And I mean, just the sheer number of runs
it's
in a
harder
year
on them.
Yeah.
You know, you're running as hard as you can run and then you're turning.
Yeah. Around breaking
the barrel,
down and turning. Yeah.
Or you're running to, you know, and the rope's thrown and you got to stop, punch back, work rope.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot more to it, really.
Right.
At least from my standpoint, having done both, you know, it's
well, a number of reps, right? I mean, there's not nearly as many outs in a year for a, you know, a 2-year-old on the track as there are for any rodeo horse.
Right.
You know?
Oh, sure.
You know, even if you count like open barrel races or jackpots or whatever, I mean, God, there's some people are putting 200 runs a year on their,
that's right,
their horse.
Yeah. Nice thoroughbred horse would run 10 times.
10 times.
Yeah.
So there's a, I mean, they're just pampered at a different level and they're not pushed as hard.
Well, and you also, a lot of difference is, you have a, if you can look in the future, you kind of plan for a date. Like, I got to have this horse ready for here.
Right.
You know, there's a stakes race. Here's what we're pointing towards. So we got to work. We're going to work backwards. We need a prep race here. I got this much time in case something happens in a prep race to get this horse ready for the stakes race. You know, you have more of a schedule. Well, you're in slack and Friday morning, you're in a perf Friday night and,
yeah,
5 hours down the road, you're in slack the next morning.
Over the fourth, yeah, you can put 3-4 runs in a day.
Yeah.
And that horse is in the trailer in between runs, you know. I mean, it's a trick, right?
Like, and they're aged horses. You think about it most of the time.
Almost always, right? Because a rodeo horse, it takes a long time to season them to do that.
I've
always found that interesting, right? And it seems like they're getting a little younger as the
barrel horses are getting younger for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know if that's just because there's less of an emphasis on fraternity derby as opposed to, like, you know, in the early 2000s, if you look early 2000s to, you know, now, there were a lot more fraternities and derbies and things available. They're kind of making a comeback with all these breeder invitationals and things like that.
They are.
But yeah. So it's coming back. But yeah, I don't know. Rodeo's just had the main focus, at least, you know, on this half of the United States. The East Coast is a little bit different. But it's interesting because not only the horses getting younger, but they're getting more valuable and they're getting faster.
They are getting
faster. It's crazy.
They are getting faster.
You know, I mean, as you who've been in this profession for, I won't even make you say how long.
35 years.
35 years. There, he said it. But way longer than I've been alive.
Thanks a lot.
I didn't mean to do that to you, but, you know, what do? It's a podcast. I mean, you've got to see, since you started, like, the evolution of horses as a whole. And, I mean, 35 years is a little over an entire generation for a horse, right, as far as their life goes.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot's changed in one generation for horses.
Well, I can remember that you know, Dr. Lewis used to take care of Scamper. Well, everybody knows who Scamper is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was the measuring stick. So great horse. But we had a picture of him hanging in the office there at Elgin, winning around at the NFR. I think it was like 14 and change.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, it's crazy. And he was the best horse going down the road. So what's the arena record now? I mean,
13-1-1.
Yeah. His sister ran.
Sister.
13-11.
Yeah. You want to talk about records? There's one horse who's got a lot of them.
Yeah. You know, so, but that's changed. I mean, you know, 14 and change winning around, it won't get you a check.
No. And, you know, there's this age old argument, and you'll see it a lot about like a horse like Sister, right? To me, that's the greatest barrel horse who's ever lived, period. You know, and I'm no gigantic, you would think I would be just based on my family. But
your pedigree.
Well, because of that stigma, I try not to be on purpose. You know, granted, I have some and, you know, and all those things. And somehow when you do that, you always get somebody asking, like, hey, you want to buy half a horse?
Yeah.
That's just what happens. But if you just look at that, purely. Yeah. And not to mention, like, I hate to be the guy who says this, but the eyes and things are far more accurate now than they were back in his days, right? And to the tune of maybe a tenth of a second better as far as the way that they clock and things like that, and everything's better. People don't like to hear that because there's this emotional attachment to some of the, you know, the Bozos and the Scampers, and as there should be. I mean, those are trailblazers. But when you look at
and tough horses.
Well, absolutely.
I mean, how many times that horse went? 9 times in a row?
Oh, God.
Wasn't it 9 times in a row?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, it might be 10, actually. But, I mean, God, you can never take that away. That's history that'll be etched for all of time.
Yeah. But what was earned.
Yeah.
And the medicine wasn't as good then.
No. The medicine wasn't as good. You know, there was no technology to help keep a horse sound going down the road. Yeah. The feed wasn't nearly as good. Yeah. The understanding of what to feed your horses and how to care for them wasn't as good.
Yeah.
Down to your equipment. Gosh, the saddles were heavier. I mean, there's a number of factors, right? But if you just look at what we saw, like, the last 2 years out of Sister, right, just totally unbiased. Take Haley out of it, take the name of the horse out of it, and you just watch it.
Yeah.
Right?
It's phenomenal.
I don't know how you compare anything to that. And we may be talking about, if that mare stays sound, we may be talking about a 15 world title. I mean, you just don't know where it's going to go. Yeah. But what we do know.
Because age is not hurting her for sure.
No, not at all. But what you do know, just by looking at it, is she's got so many records in such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
Right. And the adversity from Vegas, right, to, you know, she set the arena record at Dodge City, beat out Ivy and Tibby at that. To going to this completely new setup here in Arlington, and then going and setting the records there, setting a new WPRA record, doing all that crap.
Yeah.
Crap is a term of endearment.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know how you compare to that, even if it's a shorter time of going.
Right. I get it.
So it's pretty amazing. But for someone like you, I mean, you are behind the scenes on these type of things, right? Not necessarily Sister, but in general, right? As far as, you know, veterinary, you're behind J-Lo and things like that,
right?
Which, you know, if you talk to Ivy, you're the greatest vet who's ever lived.
Oh, Lord.
Ever. Ever.
I pay her to say that.
Yeah, exactly. Or give her discounts at least.
You're the goat of vets, according to her.
That's literally, that's what she told me. She said, no, he's the best vet. You don't understand. Like, yeah, but so-and-so thinks this, isn't it? Forget that. Marty Tanner's the best vet who's ever lived.
No.
And he'll say no, but that's how you know you might be. Because humility. If you were like, yes, I am, I'd be like, podcast over. Arrogant.
Yeah.
But the pressure to probably keep a horse sound like that, I mean, where do you start, right? If somebody comes in with a problem on a million-dollar horse like that, I mean, because these are million-dollar horses. Everyone we've talked about, I mean, they certainly are.
They're seven-figure horses, yeah.
We know that just based on the values of what some of these other horses have sold for.
Right.
You know, I mean, we've seen people that you live right really next to you. Let's say you're on their place who've paid almost that much for horses.
Yeah.
And who don't have the accolades. And you're seeing prospects being purchased for $500,000 right now, and rightfully so. I mean, the market deserves to be that valuable, in my opinion.
Right.
But where do you start? Somebody has a problem, you know, you have to piece together this puzzle of trying to solve it for them so they can get back down the road as quick as possible. And it's different, right? Because this is a living, breathing creature. It's not a truck. You can't just swap out, you know,
put
wheel bearings.
A new part on it.
Exactly. So, I mean, how do you go from point A, we've got a problem, to here's how we solve those problems?
So just go through an exam, like what we're going to do?
Well, I mean, yeah, just in general, because the way that those things kind of come in.
Well, in general, you know, usually you got, you know, you got a good horseman, horsewoman, whatever the correct term is for today's time.
Oh, we don't have
horse person.
Luckily, in our industry, these weird vernaculars don't apply.
You know, you got to listen to the client, and you got to put a history together and see if there's something that's repeating itself. Because what I've tried to study, and it's odd. I don't know if odd's the right word. There is a pattern to a problem that a horse has sometimes. It's where it is on his body. And as I listen to myself talk, it probably didn't make much sense. But
no, I get what you're saying.
You know, if a horse is going to a barrel and they're like, well, it's doing this. Well, odds are this is going to put you in this bracket. You know, in my mind, I'm not going to verbally say that probably at the time, but it's going to trigger a thought. I always tell them it's the gray hair. You know, it's going to trigger something of there's it's unique of how a particular injury will affect a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I make sure that we try to investigate that part fully, you know, because these things can hide from you. You know, most of the horses that come in, they're not head bobbing lame. They don't need me for that. You know, this thing is like, I mean, you got to look.
It's small and it's acute.
And it may be chronic.
Yeah.
But it's small, you know, it's not obvious or they probably wouldn't be there.
Right.
And so sometimes that history is important. I remember, and you remember horses, you know, and you think, I've seen that before. I've heard that before. And this is what that was. And so those are kind of things that are going through my mind when I'm looking at that horse. And I try to keep myself as buffered as I can. Like sometimes I won't get the history until I look at the horse.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll look at a horse first. Because I don't have a preconceived, oh, that's going to be this. Because then you start looking for that. And so I don't want to taint, you know, what I'm doing. I don't want to cloud it. I just want to look at the horse first, and I'll come back and get a history. And then I may go back and look at the horse again. And, you know, I don't know if that's what you were kind of asking.
No, yeah. Well, and I think that's a really fascinating answer, right? Because that creates so much more work for you, right?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, from a businessman sense, that's a not the best way to do it. I mean, maybe from a longevity standpoint, but I mean, that when you phrase it like that, and I think anybody who's listening who goes to you or would consider like who's in middle of needing a vet, I mean, that's the kind of thing you want to hear, right? You want to hear somebody say that they're going to go through these necessary steps to try to diagnose it, because that just creates a level of comfort, I feel like, you know, that you maybe wouldn't, because I mean, we all know that the human brain, especially nowadays, is like, get me to point A, point B as fast as possible, yeah. And then let me repeat this.
Yeah.
You know, but taking that approach, I just think, hey, maybe that's the only way to do it if you're going to solve long-term problems.
Yeah. To me, that's just what's where, I mean, everybody's got their pattern of how they do things. There's no one right, or as long as you get to the right answer, I guess it really matters how you get there.
Sure.
But that's how I try to approach it. You know, because some of these lamenesses I get to look at, I'm not the first one to look at them, you know, and so they're hard to figure out sometimes, you know. And then it's funny how you can recall those horses. I always tell people, they'll ask me something about a horse. Say, well, I brought a horse to you, so-and-so, you won't remember. And I'll say, yeah, it was the left hind, suspensory. What? And they're like, they look at me and say, I said, look, I don't even remember your name.
Right. But don't I remember be offended. Your horse.
I don't know what I had for breakfast, but I can remember your horse. You know, so I don't know. It's just, it's even some of the techs at the clinic, sometimes they'll look at me like, how do you remember that horse? I said, yeah. I don't know. I don't know how.
Yeah. Put a lot of pressure on everybody else. But I mean, I guess that's probably one of the things that makes you great at your job or just in general. And it seems like anybody who practices medicine on any level probably has to have a mind that operates like that to have long-term success.
I think so.
But
I think so.
Well, I mean, another question, I just always think about this. The horse toughness is a problem, right, in your industry, right?
It is.
Some of these horses are so dang tough that they almost will ignore their chronic issues or their acute issues or anything going on. I mean, to recreate something that gives you a tell from a badass rodeo horse who's just just a warrior, really, if you look at the way that they operate. I mean, it's got to be a struggle to recreate those things where you can actually get those tells, right?
Yes, it is. But in turn, it's a blessing.
Yeah.
You know, because I say this statement sometimes when I'll on a particular horse. You just get them close, and they'll give you the rest.
Right.
You know, there's some intrinsic. There's got to be some intrinsic toughness and will and want to win, you know, for that horse to win over and over and over again. You know, and so if you say, well, you can work on a tough horse or a talented horse, which one'd you rather work on? I'd rather work on the tough horse.
Yeah.
Because he'll make you look good.
Right.
You know, because he's going to do his part. You just do your part.
Right.
And there's some out there that they got a hair backwards and they're like, oh no, I'm going to run up the fence, you know?
Yeah.
And you can't, it's hard to help that horse. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Cause they, I mean,
it's hard to help that horse because you can't have him 100%. Nobody's 100%. I'm not 100% every day. Neither are you. Neither is that horse. They're no different than we are. But who's going to try when they don't necessarily feel the best? Or who's going to try when they're a little tired? Or who's going to try when, you know, something aches a little bit, but they don't know how to show it to you? You know, those horses, that's the ones that are nice to work on.
Right. Yeah, and rare, too. I mean, because there's a big language barrier between us and them. So,
there is. They speak, though. You just got to learn how to listen to them.
Yeah.
They're like J-Lo. You know, it's just do your part. She's going to do her part.
Every time.
Every time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting,
just don't
right?
get in their way.
Yeah, especially a horse like that. I mean, and Ivy is one of the best at staying out of horses' ways. I mean, Haley is too, obviously. Mm-hmm. A lot of these girls are. I mean, or these horses wouldn't be doing what they're doing. Because there's just this group of them, right? It's like you talk about Scamper. Like, can you name another horse that ran against Scamper? Maybe one, right? Like, just, right. I mean, it's just hard to, right? Or anybody, but now it's like...
Now they run those top 15. You don't know who's going to win.
You don't. Yeah, I mean, you have a good idea.
But, I know, but, yeah, but on any given year, night, but, you know.
What's I mean, this? Really, because we saw times, you know, Jimmy Smith and Emily and Ivy and Brittany and Lisa and Stevie and all these gals in the barrels. And, I mean, same thing in the tie down. There's some stuff happening in the tie down at the NFR this past year that I was shocked, you know. Really shocked what I thought to happen. Thank God I don't do pro rodeo fantasy because I would have screwed it all up. And I was sitting on the ground all 10 nights, you know, talking to them after they got done, or immediately after they got done. I was just like, oh, that's not what I expected to happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just the sports evolved and the animal athletes have evolved. And it just creates such a neat environment, I think, for all of us to be in.
Yeah. It is a good time to be associated with it. It's a good time to be in veterinary medicine, you know, because I came. When I first started out, I mean, you know, we dipped the x-rays in the tank, held them up to the light, you know.
Right.
And, you know, you had Butte and Dex, and, we had Bantamine come along, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then now we have all this regenerative medicine and, you know, all the diagnostic tools, MRI, CT, you know, things that we did not have then, you know.
Right.
And so I say it's been a good time to come along because you learned how to practice without all those things. So now they're actually a useful tool. Sometimes things are a crutch.
Right.
You know? And so, you know, like, oh, I can't figure it out. It's just doing MRI.
Right.
Well, an MRI is not the answer to everything, you know?
Right. You see that with human medicine. I mean, goodness gracious. You go in for anything, and they just want you to do an x-ray and an MRI without barely speaking to you. Yeah. You ever go to the doctor and like, oh, we should probably do an MRI. I was like, my insurance doesn't like that. You know, but it is true, right? It's like it's almost people getting these patterns no matter the profession, and that's dangerous with what you do.
I don't think you ever need to learn or not have the art to evaluate a horse.
Right.
With nothing else than yourself. And that was another good thing. I can remember I'll be on the jogging floor sometimes and the girls will be jogging and they think I'm not paying
attention.
Yeah, because I'll have my head down. And so I've gotten asked more than once, what are you doing? I said, well, when I first started out, Dr. Lewis would take me on the jogging floor and for one of these really hard to find lamenesses.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, do you see it, Marty? I said, no. And he was like, look down at the ground and listen.
And hear a toe drag or something like that?
He said, do you hear that? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, now look up. and you'd see it like that. And even to this day, if I'm looking at a horse, I'm like, I don't see a lameness wrong with that horse. I'll look at the ground and listen and see if I hear something that I didn't see. And then you can see it. I don't know. It's weird.
That, no, I mean, that's, I mean, it's an art, right? I mean, being able to figure these things out, it's like a constant game of chess just on a different board over and over and over again. And it makes sense, right? You just listen for anything you could, any irregularities. Yeah. And, yeah, because I guess you don't really want to just tell somebody, especially somebody rodeo, so that's going to be an MRI. That's going to be an MRI. I mean, it might be good for business, but it's surely going to make them start looking around, which you don't want.
Yeah.
But I guess kind of what the other thing that I was thinking to ask you was, what would you tell? Like, what do you tell people, like, as far as horse maintenance and making sure that they get the most? I mean, we're just talking about some great animals. I mean, how do you think you get the most out of them, pending there's no accidents or irregularities that can't be controlled? Just what you can control. You know, you come into a great horse, right? What is the best practice to keep this horse going, you know, to get the most out of them? You know,
probably the thing that I see the neglected the most this day and time is fitness. It's hard to hurt a fit horse.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a product of numbers and, you know, we're busy, time, you know. But I think that that's probably one thing. I mean, nobody misses nutrition much.
Yeah, it's very simple. Maybe
if there's a problem with nutrition today, it's probably over-nutrition. Then, I mean,
right.
Sometimes, you know, so many supplements, you can't get any grain in your bucket, you know. So,
right.
You know, but I think nutrition is so well, people are so well versed in it. And then
there's a million companies putting out different supplements and this, better that.
Just hit Google Equine Nutrition. You'll be reading for, you know, the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Time in the saddle.
Right.
Fitness. Knowing that horse, you know, knowing what they're going to do, getting with them, you know, I think that's one of the things that I see that misses. So when I tell people that, I say, you know, that, keep your horse fit. You know that horse. And you got to know that horse. You can't get somebody to ride that horse for you, and then, you know, you got to know that horse.
Yeah.
At the NFR, probably I spend more time getting a horse over a run than I do getting the horse ready to run.
Sure. Yeah, they're so sensitive.
You know, just typically it's a different environment for those horses. Very arid. They dehydrate really easy. You know, they get just as tense as we do.
Yep.
You know, they know they're there. And so, you know, I spend as much detail with that than I do. You know, it's not necessarily getting them. It's not an injury. It's like keeping them hydrated, keeping them in the feed tub, keeping them happy, getting them to rest. You know, you spend as much time doing that as you do anything. So I think that's part of it as well. Just husbandry, horse care.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of tools that people utilize to try to get their horses in shape, but I've always felt like nothing compares to just getting on them and exercising. Right,
saddle pads are hard to beat.
Yeah, yeah. putting them on the jogger is not the same as riding them.
It's not.
And a lot, God.
And you know why it's not? It's so not much. Just the horse.
Yeah.
It's you too. You know, it's there's a bond between you and that horse, you know? And so when you're on their back, it means something.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it always has, right? Yeah. Since the days that the horse was the car.
That you rode them to work, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing the relationship that human beings have had with horses as long as history's documented.
Yeah.
We've always had it, you know, and it's kind of makes it beautiful now that it's changed. We don't need them, but we want them.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of special how that works. Yeah. You know, just like you, you're a vet.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily want a vet because of the expense, but we need a vet.
Yeah.
Well, trying to think if there's anything else that I was wondering, or maybe a question that was posed to me to ask you. Normally it's not so many questions, we more just talk, but I'm really fascinated with just the whole idea of it. Because, I mean, I've jogged so many horses in circles at vet clinics, I just never thought to ask any questions then because I wanted to go home. Yeah. But when you have one right in your face that you can ask a lot of questions to, it's kind of fun just to get them answered, I think.
Yeah.
But I mean, you work on some of the top horses out there. You're trusted by very many, and it's, you know, I'm very thankful you stopped by to.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Yeah, I like doing stuff like this. I don't get to do it very much. Yeah.
No, it's hard to, because you're a man of high demand. But yeah, it's nice. We've got a big audience, and you know, people want to listen to different things, right?
Yeah.
You know, people love to listen to the top 15 in every event, or you know, we do a lot of political stuff and bring people from other worlds. But you know, in our industry, everything starts and stops with the horse. Right.
Yeah.
And the biggest factor of that is a healthy horse.
So yeah.
I think that's why it's important to have these conversations, because people may pick something up out of this and think, you know what, I didn't look at it that way. And thank goodness Marty Tanner came by the gauge so I can learn something. But, well, we'll let you get back to Brock, but thank you for stopping by.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Oh, you bet. Brother, let's go down. This has been The Gauge, hosted by me, Chance Conrado, produced and edited by our guy, Ty Yeager. Shout out to the executive producers, Dustin Pointer and Cody Denton. Marketing and content produced by Riley Chone. Our theme song is by Shay Ashire and the Night Howlers. Make sure to rate and review this podcast, as well as follow The Gauge on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And make sure to subscribe to The Gauge wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you guys next time.